This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling. JT Allen, this is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to the maiden voyage of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, stepping into the big boy seat here, and I have some large shoes to fill, but we'll talk about that in a moment, because what I need to do right now is bring in my co-host on this show, and that is the one and only, the chap they call Alan. Alan, how are you, sir?
I am brilliant. We are back with a vengeance, JT. Letters from Center Stage, a spin-off show from Letters from Kayfabe. While our good friend Parv is on hiatus, maybe that will appear back on the feed in the coming months. You never know, fingers crossed. But for now, we're going to step into the world of WCW, JT, aren't we?
Yes, as we call it, you know, we're not going to do the cheese platter. That's exclusive to Letters from Kayfabe. We are diving deep into the outer rim of the nostalgia mothership that was WCW. So that's what we're going with here, the outer rim of that mothership.
Oh, yeah, we're getting right to the rim throughout the episodes that we're planning to do in the future weeks. So, we're really looking forward to kind of recording this for you guys. The feedback that we got for Letters from Kayfabe was great, so much so that people were hounding me, badgering me, what else is going to, you know, you're going to do, or is going to be any more Letters from Kayfabe? So I think the audience is there. I think you guys are going to dig us going through kind of some of the weird and wonderful stuff of WCW, which there is plenty of, JT. So without further ado, we have a mailbag. We don't have a sack. We just have a mailbag. Maybe we find another name for the mailbag. It's not bulging at the moment, the mailbag, like the sack was in Letters from Kayfabe, but there's ways that people can actually write in. So the best way to do that is lettersfromcenterstage@gmail.com is our email address. So if you want to send your questions in there, or the other way you can do it is hit me on Twitter. That's @Alan_cheapshot. And if you just want to send some questions in there that way to long-time listeners who did that in the past, feel free to do it that way. But I tend to find the best way you can write a longer question, again, more of your point across, is going to be through the email route. So please, guys, send your questions into us and we'll be happy to go through them on future shows. So shall we go to question one, JT?
Yes, and get those questions in. I thrive on a throbbing sack, so let's fill it up.
My word.
Good morning and welcome back to the Power Hour. I'm Missy Hyatt and this is Missy Does the Mail for Saturday, June 20th.
So, we'll go to the first question. So, dear Alan and JT, I read online that Bruno Sammartino appeared in the NWA WCW. I know he was refereeing at Halloween Havoc 89, but did he appear at any other times as well? Really looking forward to the new show. And that's from David Smith in Portsmouth, England. So, David, you had a bit of a heads up and you're able to ask a question before we kind of published to anyone. So, that's quite good for you there. So, Bruno Sammartino in WCW, obviously a WWF mainstay, WWF legend for so many years, so many Madison Square Garden sellouts, JT. But what do you remember of Bruno Sammartino in WCW?
Yeah, I do remember a little bit. I know he did the Halloween Havoc 89 spot. The one I remembered the most, though, is that Clash of the Champions 20, when they did the 20 Years of Wrestling on TBS. That was at Center Stage Theater in Atlanta. I think a fitting, obviously, for stopping here for us, in September 92. And he came out. Remember, and that was also infamous because that Andre the Giant came out as well. So they really brought out a lot of the legends and the stars, and Bruno actually co-hosted that show. So to me, that was an interesting one. When they went ahead and did that.
Oh, yeah, it was his comments on the Clash show as well. They did a pre-tape backstage segment where Schiavone was interviewing Sammartino, and then Bruno came out and said some other league took pro wrestling in a direction he didn't like, and he was happy with the direction of WCW, and he'd like to give his thoughts on some of the matches. So it was more pro-WCW than the wacky cartoon world of WWF at the time, which is quite an interesting kind of insider comment there in some ways, wouldn't you say, JT?
Yeah, and this was definitely in its art of comedy, especially at that time. And this was clearly a shot across the bow at the WWF, who was in the middle of their, you know, steroid scandal and everything else going on, or at least, you know, beginning early parts of that and all the fallout around that. So to have Bruno, who for many years was just the face of WWF or WWWF at the time as well, having come on the competition and just fire such a clear shot at them, talking about, you know, the direction they're going in. Of course, he didn't like the cartoonishness and all that, but he was a big anti-steroid guy, and that was what WWF was just involved heavily in at the time. So this was like a major, you know, FU on the part of WCW to bring Bruno out on this show and later on, you know, Saturday Night or whatever it was, and comes out and both set him up to be involved with their programming a little bit, you know, at Halloween Havoc, and then also just taking the shot at WWF that was in the middle of this, you know, trial that could possibly have ended the promotion. So this is like heavy times, and it's just like an extra slap in the face for Vince to have to hear that a former confidant and one of his, you know, one of the all-time greats was like at the competition just ripping him.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the way he came in 92 was his old pal Bill Watts invited him to come in for a few shots. So he did the one that we mentioned there at Center Stage at Clash. He also was involved at the Halloween Havoc 92 show. He did the opening introduction with Tony Schiavone on that one. And I do believe that was the one where Ron Simmons had his match with Barbarian, if memory serves me correct. And I think he was in the corner of that, of Ron Simmons' you know, corner at the time versus the Barbarian. But I don't really remember that. That's come up on research, so I might have to double check on that one. But I think that was the Halloween Havoc 92 one. But he also, what he did do as well, he went on a little bit of a house show loop with WCW in 1996, JT. Was this something you were aware of before we kind of did the research for this question?
No, honestly, I didn't remember that at all, and I wasn't aware of it. So the research was pretty interesting that they brought him out. And it's funny, too, because his tie-in was kind of random as well, you know, refereeing the Ric Flair and Randy Savage matches. Not a ton. I guess he had some history with Savage, but not anything that would have been, you know, clear on WCW television or in WCW history. But, you know, I thought it was worth it. If you look at the cities he was in, made a lot of sense. Hartford, Philly, and New York. So that, you know, obviously big drawing areas for him at the time. And I don't know how these numbers compare, Alan. Like, you know, they did around 3,000 to 4,000 paid in each of the cities, 3,500 paid in New York at the Paramount. So, you know, obviously a smart targeting to have him there. And I think it was around this time, too, that didn't David Sammartino show up on Nitro? So I wonder if that was part
of
it.
Oh, there's always that. I mean, you know, Bruno was always pushing for David. And David Sammartino in 1996 was a completely different-looking human being than the one that we saw, you know, 10 years removed in WWF, wasn't he? He was cut to shreds in these 96 appearances in WCW. And I think that he showed up on an episode of Nitro at least once as well, JT. That being David, not Bruno.
Yes, yeah, David definitely showed up on Nitro for a match, and you're right, he looked, I mean, not even, you know, on the Place to Be podcast, Scott Criscolo and I, you know, were talking about some of his matches in 85 at MSG, and just, you know, talked about his large derriere and everything else he had going on, and very stout and very built up, but yeah, by this time in WCW, when he shows up on Nitro, definitely looks completely different, and I'm actually pulling up right now, so he, yeah, he fought Dean Malenko for the Cruiserweight title in 3 minutes. And then it was actually part of a big brawl at the end of the show. And I guess they did on the Nitro right before that, on June 24th, they announced that Bruno would be guest refereeing on the tour of the Northeast. So they actually announced it on TV. So it wasn't hidden, which is good. And then David was on right after that. It was later in the year. So it was December when David showed up.
So he must have done the groundwork, Bruno, and then Davey got in shape, obviously, and did his little appearances in WCW. But the first time, getting back to the first time he appeared in NWA / WCW, would have been the Halloween Havoc 89 pay-per-view, where he was the guest referee in the Thunderdome main event, which was an interesting match, wasn't it? It was Ric Flair and Sting with Ole Anderson, and they beat Terry Funk and the Great Muta, who had Gary Hart and Dragon Master Kendo Nagasaki with them in a Thunderdome match, which was quite an interesting kind of take on the cage match, wasn't it?
Yeah, and again, and this may tie in maybe to topics we'll get to eventually here, is how outside of the box WCW would go. And matches like this, to me, are prime examples with stuff like the Thunderdome. And I like the Thunderdome. I thought it definitely made things stand out. And I thought Bruno was the ref made sense. Again, they were in Philly, a hotbed for him. So I thought it added value to have him there. He was pretty recently had just left the WWF, right? Was it like late 87 or so when he finally severed ties with them?
Yeah, he was very, very bitter about, you know, a lot of things that went on in the WWF. So I wonder how this was taken by WWF when he showed up at the pay-per-view. And it's a weird one, really, if you think about it, because he's a champion of your rival promotion and you're pushing him as a legend in your promotion. So it's a bit of a weird dichotomy, you know, with what went on previous in his previous career, that he was never really featured in this area of the country.
Yeah, they had to be really, really vague about it. I mean, I think... You know, my read on it is that in the late 80s, I would say WCW's fan base, Jim Crockett's fan base, was probably a little bit of a smarter level fan as far as awareness. You know, I think there's a lot of them that very much believed in what they were seeing, but just general awareness of the wrestling landscape. The WWF was very insular, especially by the late 80s, where they rarely talked about anything else going outside. And if you were a WWF fan, you were pretty much in the bubble of the WWF. They had their own magazine, they had their own videotape, you know, like they had everything you could possibly want as a wrestling fan in many ways as a kid. But I feel like WCW, their audience trended older, so I feel like they may have had that base knowledge to know, so even if it was subconsciously through magazines or just through hearsay, of who Bruno Sammartino is versus, like, you know, I don't know, Lou Thesz or Harley Race pre-King showed up in WWF in 88. Kids probably don't know as much of who they are. Whereas, yeah, like a Bruno showing up in NWA was a little bit more, you know, I think the fan base is probably more adept to know who he was.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing would have been that, you know, a lot of the NWA kind of coverage was in the Aptomags, and also a lot of Sammartino in the early days of the Aptomags, he was all over them. So I don't know if there's a kind of tie in there where they would have recognized him. So, yeah, that one's really to discuss Bruno. I don't think he's really going to come up in WCW kind of discussion again. So that will be the kind of last time we really hear from Bruno. But he was someone that was used well, as we said. And I think he that last run in 96, well, I mean, there was, like we said, they drew 4,000, you know, then 3,500 and 3,200. I don't know if he made much of a difference at that point. The audience had moved on in 96. I think the landscape had changed slightly. But I think his earlier appearances definitely were something that would have helped, not hindered WCW.
And I think it's worth a shot. I mean, when you figure, like, there may be a few lingering fans that just see his name advertised locally. Oh, you know, may have watched wrestling forever, but see Bruno is going to be there. Maybe they get the itch to go and maybe get hooked. Like, I can't imagine he commanded much of a salary. So I think whatever they invested in him was probably worthwhile just to see. I mean, if you look at some of these other non-Nitro attendances, you know, they were lower than what they drew with Bruno. So, you know, maybe he was a slight bump at the gate. And maybe he helped out a little bit. And, of course, it was around this time, you know, it was probably a little before this, when they decided to really curtail the house shows because they just weren't drawing at all. And then they would get that bump from the Savage Flair feud. So, you know, all around, I think it was probably worthwhile to bring him in at that point, even if his name was fading, just because of the strategic arenas that they did it in. If they did it, like, in Charlotte or something, you'd say, okay, it doesn't really make sense. But to hit those three spots where Bruno was a big name made a ton of sense to me.
A ton of sense and WCW in the same sentence.
You're not going to hear that much on these, yes, for sure.
No, that's for sure. Right, so we'll go to the second question in the mailbag now, and that is, dear Alan and JT, was it just me, or were the rings in WCW smaller than those in WWF in the 90s? And that's from Mr. X in Parts Unknown. So thank you very much for the question, Mr. X. And yes, definitely right there, JT, wasn't it? The rings in WCW were smaller than the WWF.
Yeah, is that our old friend Tom Pritchard writing in on a mystery? I guess we'll never know. yeah, the WCW rings were definitely smaller than WWF, but the funny thing is, they were more the standard. It's WWF that's actually, you know, bigger. So that's the funny part of it, is whereas WCW, because it was smaller, seemed to stand out more, whereas WWF was actually the one that was more outside of the norm, which I think made sense. I mean, at the time, they used much bigger guys. But also, you know, gave them a little bit more room to tell the story. WCW... definitely was always very noticeable. I mean, even as a kid, first getting into WCW, like, it was glaringly noticeable to me. It wasn't something that I just picked up on later as I learned about it. I don't think it was necessarily a bad thing, though. I think it just made it stand out a little bit more. Anything you noticed about the size of the rings at that time?
Well, I completely noticed it as well. Coming from watching the WWF, that was my first initial kind of route to wrestling in some ways. And the WCW, I'd see you know, 6 months later, and it was noticeable for me as well. But the interesting thing is, the like you said, the WCW rings were 18 by 18, 18 foot by 18, and the WWF WWE rings are, you know, famously 20 by 20. And the only other organization that I can think of that uses a 20 by 20 ring is Noah. I do think that there's some Lucha Libre groups, promotions, or there used to be, that used even bigger rings. I think they even went up as big as 24 by 24, which is absolutely huge, really. You know, especially for running the ropes, you'll be out of breath after doing a couple of them. But yeah, the ring was definitely noticeably smaller, and that wasn't really anything that really took me away from the product. It didn't kind of make me think, oh, it's inferior because of that. I don't know about you, but did it really make you, did it jar you at all from enjoying the, you know, WCW?
No, I don't think it was small enough that it made it seem like rinky-dink. I mean, most of the production value, but especially by the time where I started against the WCW, was high enough that it looked good. I mean, it was just, you know, and I guess you'd see it sometimes like in Center Stage Theater or in the MGM studios where it was on that little spinny platform. So, like, I guess for that, it kind of almost, you know, made sense. Like, okay, they're running these venues, and I don't know. I mean, I don't think it ever took anything away from me, and it never really clouded my view. I'm curious how the wrestlers thought about it, because obviously you have a little bit less room to move, a little bit less room to work. Like you said, maybe they're not getting as winded hitting the ropes because it's a shorter run, but you get to think the timing and the planning of your moves all has to be adjusted if you're going from the WWF to WCW, just having less room to move. Like if you're going to suplex a guy, you have to be a few steps further away from the ropes than you would have in the WWF. So just minor things that may have been, you know, second habits to these guys, just without thinking, just subconscious, all of a sudden all you have to adjust your entire style. Like I wonder how much of that was, you know, played into guys getting adjusted to that size.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've heard that, you know, a lot of the guys over the years, including guys like Austin and Bret Hart, have commented on how much they like the WWF's ring better. A lot of guys talk how the, you know, it was hard to their timing in a bigger ring to get the timing down, but once they got it, they never actually wanted to go back to a smaller ring at all. So I think it's one of them that once you, you know, you got cemented and used to a 20 by 20, it's very hard to go back. Very much like a car, you drive a very big car, it's very hard to go back to a smaller car after
right.
that. Maybe.
Well, you know, once you go bigger, it's hard to go back sometimes.
Oh, I.
it's an interesting situation. I mean, they also had, of course, other minor differences. The ropes were different. You know, the general padding. If you remember, the turnbuckles in the WWF had those big, you know, of course, you just think of George Steele eating one. So, I mean, you can picture what those were like, those big, bulky ones. WCW seemed to have more of just, like, that, like, flat pad that folded almost like a taco, you know, around the turnbuckle. That's what it always looked like to me. And so to me, that actually added in a little bit of extra illusion of toughness, that it seemed like they were more likely to really feel a blow to the turnbuckle in the WCW ring versus WWF, which is more padded.
No, definitely. The taco, just looking at that, I'm just looking at a picture of one here. Definitely taco turnbuckles. We're going to make that a term.
Definitely looked like a taco, especially if you had that orangish color. But the to me, at least for the WWF, even though it didn't look as vicious, they could use the trope of unbuckling the turnbuckle pad and exposing the steel buckle, which WCW didn't seem to make as much of a difference. I don't remember them ever really doing it in any big matches. WWF, it was a big time thing.
Oh yeah, it was definitely. And the other major difference was the ropes themselves. The WCW ropes were steel cables instead of real ropes, and the ropes were lower than in WWF's rings. Weirdly enough, the top rope barely came to Hogan's mid-back in WCW compared to in the WWF when it was, you know, a lot higher. And the rigging under the ring is apparently different as well. And the padding was slightly different. It's actually thicker in the WWE or WWF after 98. So just touching on WWF, they changed the ring significantly when Vince started working, didn't they?
Those old bones were hurting, so they had to give him the extra padding and clean it up a bit. Which is surprising to me. They didn't do it sooner. I mean, I don't know what the financial investment is. Maybe because they were making more money in 98, they could afford to fix it up a little bit. But just to help prevent from some injuries, you would think, you know, that would be one of the things they'd look at. The money you're losing on the injury front could probably be offset by spending a little bit extra on the ring.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad they did that for the, you know, the guys, you know, to, you know, have a future. I mean, you bump in like they do now on, you know, rings like that, then they would have been 2 or 3 years in and they'd be done. So I'm really glad that they made that change.
Ladder matches on those rings? Like even think of some of the ones that did happen, like Shawn and Razor having theirs, like falling off ladders onto that thinner setup, the extra toll on their body.
Brutal. Yeah, and the other thing, the difference between the real ropes and the more steel cables, the real ropes loosen over time. Steel cables don't really do that. So when people bounce around and spring off them doing springboard moves, it's harder to do on real ropes. you know, in the third, fourth, fifth match. So a lot of the Flyers prefer the steel cables than the ring ropes in the WWE, which is interesting. So that's the major differences between the two. I mean, WCW rings being 18 by 18, that's the same size as ECW had Ring of Honor, TNA when they had the square ring as well. I mean, here in the UK, I don't think you will have ever seen this, but rings went really small, JT. They went down as small as like 12 by 12, 14 by 14. They look ridiculous.
It can't be smaller than the all-time smallest ring I've seen, which was a TNA house show in a casino ballroom here in Rhode Island. And it was a six-sided ring. I don't even know how to describe the size of this thing. I mean, I don't think both guys could have laid across it. Like, if one guy suplexed another one, I don't think they would have fit the length of the ring. That's how tiny it was. It was absurd. I mean, I don't know how they had matches.
So you're basically telling me you watched a wrestling show in a paddling pool-sized wrestling ring.
Yeah, it was...
You know, a kid's paddling pool.
It was ridiculous. I mean, when I would wrestle like my wrestling buddy in my living room, I had a much bigger space than what these guys were working with in this tiny, tiny room in this tiny, tiny... ring. It was jarring when we walked in. I was like, you know, it almost felt like it was like a demo ring for like fans to practice in or something, like a scale ring, you know. And then when I realized that was actually where they were going to wrestle in, I was like, oh crap, that thing doesn't really hold, give you much room to maneuver in.
No, I think, definitely, I enjoyed that question, talking about the ring. So thank you very much for that question, Mr. X. Hopefully we find out what your identity is in future weeks. So shall we now move on, JT?
Yeah, I think we should. I think it's time to move on. I'm just getting word now that it is time to go on the road, Alan, with our 1-800-COLLECT-ROAD-REPORT, looking back at this week in WCW history.
The United Center, but tomorrow night we're going to be at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. We've already sent our good friend Lee Marshall there, and he reports in from Milwaukee on the road with 1-800-COLLECT. Lee, are you cold?
Tony, I am cold, but the only thing keeping me warm here is the cheeseheads. I mean, the fans here haven't been this excited since the Bucks won the coin toss and got Lou Alcindor as their first pick.
Well, WCW history this week. I mean, we're in the week of Spring Stampede, and we're going to focus on Spring Stampede 1998, which was on this day in April the 19th, so on this week. So it was, as we record this, it was the day before in 98. And this was 7,428 in attendance with 275,000 homes watching on pay-per-view. So as far as a big drawing show, middle of the road, I would say, on that one. And the main matches on the show were Goldberg defeated Saturn, which earned him a US title shot. And then we had Psychosis beat La Parka. We had Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash defeat Roddy Piper and the Giant in a baseball bat on a pole match. And that was a match where we saw the Giant spanking Hulk Hogan over his knee, which was a very interesting visual to have. We also had on this show, we had DDP getting beat by Raven in a Raven rules match. Mm-hmm. That's where Raven won the US title. And then we had Randy Savage beat Sting in an ODQ match to win the WCW world title. So that was quite an eventful show, JT. Do you remember, you know, any specific memories from that show? Did you order it at the time?
I did not order it. A good friend of mine had a black box for most of my youth. So I would usually, if I didn't go over for the WCW events, and I usually didn't unless it was on like a school vacation week or the summer. But I'd get the tape pretty soon after. There are a couple of the matches we'll note here. One is the all-time mail-it-in match, and that is Kurt Hennig with Rick Rude versus the British Bulldog with Jim Neidhart. Those four guys in 1998 in WCW were complete, just like phoned in. I mean, that is the four guys pairing together. Bulldog and Neidhart, of course, had jumped over after Montreal and just looked like they'd rather be anywhere else in the fucking world than in WCW at that point.
And this is pre Bulldog's injury as well, isn't it? This is pre trapdoor, because the Warrior trapdoor wasn't till, you know, the autumn, the fall time of 98, if I remember.
Yeah, fall. Yeah. So he just a real underscript run here in 98. And then also Booker T and Chris Benoit fought over the WCW TV title, of course. So that was, I don't know if that was part of the best of seven or if it came afterward. It's not noted here. So, but they were having their feud. But yeah, that the Raven DDP, that was a big match because they had that really good feud going on. Benoit was included as part of it as well. Remember they had the triangle match.
Yes.
I remember that being a really well regarded and hyped feud, especially across the internet, between those two guys. So Raven getting the US title felt like a really big win at the time.
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed Raven's run in WCW around this time. He was winning the US title here. And the interesting thing about this match was, well, not interesting as such. I mean, WCW were really fantastic, and we're hopefully going to touch on this in later, you know, episodes of different sets for pay-per-views. So on this show, we saw Raven diving off what looked like a kind of it was DDP, sorry, diving off, like a kind of horse and carriage from the top of it onto Raven, like a cowboy theme thing, because it was Spring Stampede. So WCW did real kind of interesting sets, and they could play it into some of the matches that they had over the years. So that's something, as I said, we'll hopefully touch on in the later weeks. So that pay-per-view for me, it was an enjoyable show. I've not watched it in the full show in years and years, but 1998 WCW, yeah, the signs were there, things were going to go wrong, that was inevitable, but they did put on some fun shows, and this was, you know, a good example of that.
Yeah, 98 is an interesting time because, like you said, the signs were there, but everyone was so into it, and the ratings were still high, and the attendance was still good. You know, I think they figured they were so hot that it would be impossible to cool off. And I think we saw the same thing with the WWF a couple years later, where you don't realize the warning signs until they're in the rearview mirror. R.D. Reynolds, the history of, or the death of WCW book, I thought touched on a lot of good points with that, where you are floated artificially by ticket sales when you're red hot, because you're selling out so far in advance that it's not really a good indicator of where you're at business-wise, right? So they may put tickets out in advance 4 months out for like the Georgia Dome, and they're going to sell the place out. No one cared because they're so hot. They didn't, you know, it didn't matter what the product was, but by the time you get there, okay, now you're in a sold out arena, but you're not really realizing you're convincing yourself you're okay because you've sold out the Georgia or whatever. You packed X amount of thousands to the Georgia Dome, that you're tricking yourself into thinking you're still a hot product when you're missing all the glaring warning signs around you. And I think the same thing is true with ratings too.
Oh, yeah, in some ways. But on the other hand, you've got, at this point in time, you've got Goldberg heating up. He's molten hot at this point. So you feel as, you know, as Eric Bischoff, who as ever, we've got this guy here. This is our guy. This guy can kind of be bigger than Austin. And really, I don't think they really put that much thought into the booking. You know, sorry, not too much thought. They obviously put thought into it, the wrong type of thought, because it wasn't great for the future, the way that they were kind of going, the route they were going. But I think at the time, you're very blinkered, and you can see you've got this one guy who you think's the big star, and you're doing great business still. So maybe, you know, if you're in that position, you may have kind of thought the same thing.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Right. You feel like you're set for the present and you're set for the future. The problem is, when they finally bite the bullet and go with the future, they still hang on way too much to the past, and that's what ended up doing them in. If you look at the time frame between when Goldberg was getting really hot, which was, you know, whatever you want to say, early 98, maybe late 97, and then more 98. If you look at the time, so would you agree with me that even though he's heating up, this match the next night, so we can talk about it now. The next night on Nitro, Goldberg beats Raven. So Raven has a one-day reign as U.S. champion. Goldberg wins the next night. Would you agree with me that that's really the start of, like, his hottest period? Like, this is where it's all kicking off. He mows through Raven, wins the U.S. title, and he's clearly moving up the ladder.
Oh, completely. The Raven match is, I would class that as a match where all the planets aligned and it was perfect for what it was. Really, really perfect. You saw Goldberg basically destroy all the flock, and even did the jackhammer on the big guy in the flock. What was he called? Ron Reyes was his real name, I think. Yeah, God, what's his name now? Going to annoy me. It was Reese. Yeah, Ron Reese.
Wasn't that his name in the flock? Wasn't it?
Yes, you know, he was as well. Yeah, it was just called Reese. You're right. We did the jackhammer on him, and he was a good 7 foot guy. And it, you know, it was a great visual. You had Raven trying to escape through the crowd, and the crowd threw him back over the guardrail. And then, you know, the whole jackhammer and pin on Raven, and the crowd. What a pop! That's for a short 5 minute, you know, TV match. That was as perfect as you're going to see. So WCW did a lot of things wrong, but this was one thing. They knocked it out the park with this match.
So then when you look at that, though, and you say, okay, we're set for the future and the past, and it's amazing because I would say his heat, well, he was still really great after this. When Kevin Nash beats him at Starrcade is when it all gets pissed away, right? So if you look at this, they think they're set up for long-term success into the future. Goldberg's peak run was only 8 months at best. You know what I mean? It's like, it's crazy to think, because he was around longer than that and he was a main focus longer than that. But that period where they had lightning in a bottle, how many pay-per-views does he even main event? Just the one with DDP, I think, right? And then he loses to Nash. Like, I think that's it.
When the Halloween Havoc one that we'll touch on in a future episode, hopefully, where the whole debacle without a pay-per-view at the end, where pissed off a lot of pay-per-view buyers because it was aired free the next night, because a lot of pay-per-view carriers cut the feed off after 3 hours and the match, you know, ran over. So that was something we can get into on a future episode. But yeah, I would say you've hit the nail on the head there, JT. the kind of lightning in the bottle struck this week in 98, and then it ended Starrcade.
Right, and then he's not even at, you know, he wins the title, and, you know, then he's not even at Fall Brawl. I think it was Road Wild is that Battle Royal. Remember, he's not even the main event of that. World War III, he's not the main event of that. And, you know, and then Starrcade. So it's crazy to me to think, I mean, and just to kind of extrapolate your point, that Bischoff is sitting here thinking, oh, we have the future. This guy's a monster. He's mowing through everyone. How little they really capitalized on how hot he was is amazing to me. It's just, it's crazy what a quick star he was and how quick he ended up burning out as a potential draw. And I think the WWF did the same thing with RVD in 2001. Like, I think they had this brief period where this comet was in the sky, you know, blazing, and they let it burn out before they ever really made a lot of money off of it. And
oh, it's the same with Jeff Hardy to a degree as well, but we're kind of divulging there. But this is a great example of having a guy but not going all the way as the main guy, even though he's got the title. The Ultimate Warrior in the WWF in 1990 was another great example of this, because Hogan was still lingering around. You had double main events, co-main events. You know, SummerSlam being the example of that, where you had Rude versus Warrior and you had Hogan Earthquake. So, yeah, you can't really establish a guy unless the previous guys, you know, tail off and disappear for a bit.
It was just bad timing for them, because they obviously had the stuff planned with Hogan, whether it was Jay Leno, Rodman, and Malone. So you can't really phase them out. If I were them, I would have gotten past that and had Goldberg just maybe try and stave it off a little bit and have him win it when you have a time where Hogan can go away. Because Hogan still being around is what really killed. And it's the same thing you said with Warrior 90. Like, Hogan still being around just killed any chance Goldberg had to be purely on top. Because whether he's feuding with Jay Leno, Karl Malone, and Rodman, Ultimate Warrior, like, all of it is just in the way of Goldberg becoming the guy.
Yeah, I think we've really hit the nail on the head with Goldberg there. They had lightning in a bottle, and it literally lasted 6 or 7 months, you know,
amazing,
max.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I think that's a good on this week in history to kind of discuss that. So, shall we move on now to the long-form question?
Yeah, I think it is time to move on to that question. I'm excited about
it. Okay, so, dear Alan and JT, WCW is a promotion filled with mistakes and gaffes throughout their history. So
we discovered one.
Well, you're telling me. Some of the mistakes are more famous than others, such as the Shockmaster falling through the wall and his mask coming off. Can you tell me some of the lesser-known issues that WCW encountered? And that's thanks. And it doesn't actually say who this is from, so I've got the email address. I don't really want to read that out. Mm. Someone sent this to me. But, yeah, thank you to that person. So appreciate the question. So WCW mistakes, I mean, this is one segment. We're not going to go into them all here, otherwise we'd be doing a kind of between the sheets type length podcast, you know, not never mind a kind of quick bite-sized look at WCW. So yeah, we're going to go through quite, you know, a few of them here, you know, from the earlier, like from 90 really onwards to, you know, 93, we'll touch on some here. So if anyone else wants to kind of discuss these with us, what we're going to have as well, we're going to have a thread in the Pro Wrestling Only message board. There's going to be a thread in the podcast and publication section, so people can have a discussion there about what their memories are. And also, you can also hit us up on Twitter, obviously myself at @Alan_Cheapshot, and yourself, JT, just to mention it quickly, you're at Place to Be Nation, is that right?
Correct, and it's the number 2, so Place number 2 and then Be Nation is how you can reach us at Twitter. And of course, maybe we'll be sharing these memories in a kayfabe form as well, we'll see.
So what have you got? What's kind of some things that you've discovered in the first few years of WCW?
Well, jumping ahead, and then I'll go back. You nailed one of my favorite ones. You already talked about is the Halloween Havoc cutting off the pay per view. I mean, that's a classic one. But of course, we have the Road Warriors defeating the Midnight Express back at the Kiel Auditorium in May of '90. The Road Warriors decided to just let an interfering Paul Ellering pin an interfering Jim Cornette. And the Road Warriors just came up with the finish on the fly because they were out of the way out of the company and didn't want to beat Eaton and Lane clean. So they wanted to give them a friendly little benefit from them leaving. They didn't want to bury them on the way out the door. And they said, fuck it, we'll just do it with things our own way. And to me, that shows like the lack of overall leadership in WCW. Like, it's just a minor example of not having that oversight that these guys are running the asylum a bit, will go completely unpunished. And it just, to me, that always symbolized what WCW was. No one voice of power and control. Like, can you picture WWF, something like this happening? I mean, it's happened the other way where they've screwed people, but can you picture like guys going into their own,
No. Going to business for themselves. No, definitely not. And this wasn't really business for themselves. This was business for the good of the company that they're leaving, because, you know, we all know the stories we've heard them all from Jim Cornette over the years of you know, Midnight Express, how they were ruined because of Jim Herd. And this is a prime example of that. You've got two guys in the Road Warriors. This is May, and you know, they were pretty much gone, you know, month or so after this, weren't they? So they knew the writing was on the wall with them. So they went into business for themselves and let, you know, Cornette pin Ellering. So in a way, the classic Road Warriors, they don't want to do the job themselves, but they're still doing the right thing. And, right, I'll applaud them for that.
And I guess the one time it did happen in WWF was with the click, you know, the farewell, the curtain call. But if you look at it, to me, that's like the one time where Vince was at his softest, because he was in such a, you know, that was the one time Vince ever got worked over by someone, because he was in such a fetal position from getting battered, you know, and just having no control. And that's like the one time in history. So that it felt very WCW-ish at the time. And yeah, the Road Warriors still, at the end of the day, doing the right thing, but also, like you said, protecting themselves as well.
Yeah, but that just shows, like I said, Jim Herd's kind of hatred for certain individuals that are under contract. They were still going to be under contract for a number of months after, and still, you know, not letting them get the rub off a team that was on a way out. So it was just a daft decision all around there. So I'm glad that kind of worked out the way it did. So one that I uncovered was just actually a week or two after this, again with the Midnight Express, they beat Brian Pillman and Tom Zenk. And after the bout, a fan hit Jim Cornette and gave Jim a bloody nose. So what Cornette did, he responded by repeatedly hitting the fan with a tennis racket. And what actually happened, which, you know, Cornette, in his way, has got every right to do to defend himself. But what was revealed later on was the fan was mentally handicapped, and the incident was picked up by local media in the Columbia, South Carolina area. So not a good look for WCW.
Imagine,
but it's one of those
today.
Things. Oh God, yeah, he would. There'd be lynchings. There'd be demands on Twitter for, you know, public lynchings of people doing that. But in the heat of the moment, Jim Cornette's just protecting himself. He doesn't probably notice that the guy's, you know, handicapped. He may not be able to tell that he's mentally handicapped, because there's nothing physical, obviously, you know, from sight. So what he does, he just responds. But yeah, it's just, that's just an unfortunate kind of thing that really happened. But that's WCW for you. You know, they're kind of cursed in some ways, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's like, there's the next one from February 91 where they, again, nothing they did wrong, but it's just that curse of WCW. Ric Flair, their world champion, hospitalized for getting burned by having coffee spilled on at McDonald's, misses some time, not as much as they thought, but again, just like, what can go wrong will go wrong in the world of WCW. Your world champion, your most recognizable name, and now you got to pull them off the road and miss a couple of shows, probably do refunds. I don't know if they were doing that at the time, but eventually they would start doing stuff like that, where if a big name didn't show up, they'd have to refund the fans, all because, you know, he had a coffee spilled on him at McDonald's. And I wonder, was that the incident that triggered the Seinfeld episode with Kramer spilling the cafe latte on himself and the company?
Yeah, it's just crazy to think that, you know, I'm just trying to think now, burning yourself with coffee. I'm sat there. Is Ric Flair just wearing no trousers? That's potentially true. That could happen with Ric Flair. But, you know, if you're wearing trousers or jeans or something, surely, even if it's a, you know, it must have been a pot of coffee, I don't know, but a small glass of, or, you know, mug of coffee, is it going to stop burn, give you third-degree burns? It's going to stop you wrestling? I don't know.
I guess maybe if he had shorts and burnt his leg, or it could have been his hand. Maybe he burnt his hand, spilt it there, and he couldn't really, you know, grab hold of anything because he had burns on his hand. That's possible.
Yeah, but it's a bit of a wacky injury there that's not really kind of discussed. So that's another WCW one. And then this is classic WCW here, JT. So we had a WCW house show in Phoenix, Arizona at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum on September the 6th, 91. It was cancelled because the ringer didn't arrive and only 450 fans showed up. So
what's sadder? If you're a promotion, a major promotion with national TV that's been around forever, and you only draw 450 fans, or if you're a fan, you're all excited to go to the show and the ring doesn't show up, so you have to cancel the show. Like, and they're not, that Phoenix isn't really an area that they run often. You know, it's not like Greensboro where, oh, they'll be back next month. I mean, this might have been these fans' only chance to really see WCW action, and they might have been excited about it, and they show up.
Yeah,
and
it's not
the ring.
And then it doesn't happen. Yeah, it doesn't. The thing is, though, as well, it's Phoenix. It's a major city. It's not some small backwater town. So 450 people. But this is WCW, you know, 91. Flair had left. There was all those chants, you know, we want Flair, we want Flair. The company was in a bit of kind of a transitional period at this time. But still, the ring didn't arrive. What sort of mismanagement can cause that in a promotion that's owned by a company the size of, you know, Turner, TBS?
And how can you not find a ring? I mean, there's going to be a ring somewhere. Go to a local gym, boxing gym. You know, it had to be something you could piece together. I mean, maybe it's not built the same way to bump, but I mean, there had to be someone locally that they could find a ring from in the area. I mean, I guess maybe Phoenix wasn't really a bastion of territory wrestling at the time, so maybe there was a dearth of rings. But, yeah, for a major company like this to not have it coordinated to have the ring arrive at the freaking arena is mind-boggling.
Do you remember the time that there was an indie show a few years ago, and I think it was Nikolai Volkov and someone else were working, and the ring didn't show up, so they just worked on gym mats in front of about 60 people? What a visual.
Yeah, I got some tape of that from my basement as well, on gym mats, no ring. That's the level that they were at.
God, yeah. It's, another good example of this is a good one. So WCW, September the 5th, 92. So just less than a year after the one we've just mentioned. This is in Dallas, Texas at the Sportatorium, funnily enough, where World Class ran for all those years. So during the show, an elderly man accompanied by his personal nurse attempted to shoot Jake Roberts. So the man had attempted shows at the Sportatorium for 30 years without incident. And then on this show, he attempts to shoot Jake Roberts. Bill Watts sent word to the crew that if Jim Crockett showed up, just bear with me. Yeah, it was a man. So I don't know if that was kind of what was going on there. That was a kind of something that was a joke played on Jake Roberts as a rib, because I've got it mentioned here that Bill Watts sent word to the crew that if Jim Crockett showed up, then he would have to buy a ticket to get in and he wouldn't be allowed anywhere near the dressing room. So I don't know if that's linked to this, if they were making a joke that, but yeah, that's something that I uncovered, that potentially an old man, but yeah, I don't think it was Bill Watts. He wasn't at the Sportatorium for 30 years, but that's crazy. A lot of heat then, maybe, that Jake Roberts had garnered in WCW at the time for a man to do that.
You think this guy was just biding his time, like waiting it out until Jake Roberts finally make the appearance? Like, he just hated him so much that he had just waited this whole time. And maybe the nurse was in on it too, you think? And she had the gun in her purse or something. I'm wondering how deep this thing goes. How much?
Well, it could have been waited all those years since last time that Roberts worked World Class, you know, years previous. So it could have been from, you know, waiting all those years, like you said. So that's quite interesting and quite scary as well. And also, in a way, for someone like Jake Roberts, maybe slightly satisfying.
Yeah, right.
You know, that is, I'm doing my job. I'm the king of the heels. And he was getting into a lot of trouble personally around this time. But 91, 92, into 93, when he was working AAA in Mexico, he was a fantastic heel, you know, in WCW, in WWF, and in Mexico at the time. So I could see, you know, him riling up someone that much that this could happen.
He was the Texan in World Class, right? Maybe this guy hated him as far back as then and realized who he was under the hood, and then that was it. Came for his revenge.
Yeah. That's exactly it. And then the final one that I could cover up that we're going to discuss on this show is getting back to center stage, JT. So this was April the 12th, 1993, a Saturday night taping. This is a humdinger. The show was cancelled at the last minute when it was realised that the TBS production trucks were with the Atlanta Braves and Atlanta Hawks, respectively. So the production trucks couldn't get there because they were busy filming other TBS-related owned products. So the show was rescheduled for the 21st of April. And all that basically happened on that show was Keith and Kent Cole, Eric Watts and Marcus Alexander Bagwell signed autographs for the fans that showed up. So, ooh, lucky them. So the guys that, you know, the ring, things didn't show up, and then they get the Cole twins, dirt worst Eric Watts, and massive geek Marcus Alexander Bagwell showing up. They're just the biggest geeks going. So realistically, they could have had anyone in 93. They could have sent Davey Boy Smith, Sting, Vader, whoever. No, we'll send Keith and Kent Cole because we don't really give a shit about the fans. So that's what that says to me there.
It's a bigger kick in the dick than just canceling the shows, is having these guys come out like it's supposed to be a, oh, we're sorry, here you go, here's our apology, having these scrubs come out and, you know, sign autographs. I'm surprised they didn't send this State Patrol or one of those, like, the real job-level teams out there. That's a good one, though. How do you have a televised event in your major production company and the trucks just don't show up?
Just ineptitude.
Right? You'd think they would have had that coordinated. Or, I mean, there's no local TV station they could go borrow some guys from, or union guys that could call last minute. They had to move the show out. And I wonder how this affected their TV. Like, did they have, you know, turnaround that they had to then re-air something? Or were these taped so far in advance, I guess, that maybe it didn't matter? But yeah, that's crazy to me that they would do something like that.
Well, it's still inconvenient for the boys. That's an extra day at tapings that they're going to have that they didn't have to do. And you know, in those days, the tapings went for, you know, hours and hours and hours. So, and all the, you know, the wrestlers would all have to hang around all day for these tapings. So you can see why sometimes they were, you know, pissed off with WCW in general, you know, for, you know, stupid mistakes like this.
It was stupid. And there's a lot of these things. I think, you know, we'll have to come back to this every few episodes because there are ones, too, that we can, we could spend a whole episode around their TV taping gaffes where guys winning belts and then getting fired and, you know, or whatever, like the negative day title reigns they would do where, team would lose the belt and then win it a week later on TV, you know, and then it would air that they lost it, like stuff like that. Sid winning or not winning. He was shown taped as champion to air after he won the title, gets fired for the scissor incident. So they had to can all the footage they had of him as champion and refilm stuff. So, I mean, there's so many of those little things like that, that WCW is known for. One of my favorites, and maybe we can wrap with this one, is one of my favorites is Bill Goldberg when he smashes the window of the limousine on, I think it was the big January, you know, episode to kick off the new year. I don't think it was the 99, I think it was 2000. He comes out to chase after, oh, maybe it was the one with Elizabeth, right, where she pretends that she was raped or whatever. So he goes out and he tries to smash the limo window, and they didn't gimmick the window and they didn't tell him. So he drops the lead pipe he's supposed to use and just says, fuck it, and smashes the window with his arm and slices up his whole arm, cuts an artery or whatever, and he had to be, you know, end up missing time because of it. So that's just like classic, again, just what can go wrong goes wrong for WCW. Their top star on the biggest night with their major angle slashes his arm up, cutting up, you know, breaking a window in a limousine.
Yeah, I think like we said, we'll get back to some of these gaffes because we can do shows and shows and shows on them. So we've got plenty of material there if you guys want to ask the questions again. So I think that pretty much wraps it up for the first episode, JT.
That was a fun sprint. I had a blast. I think we're going to have a lot of great topics to cover, and I'm really looking forward to our journey here around the outer rim of that mothership.
Oh, the mothership, yeah, definitely on the outer rim. That's where we're going to try and stick to throughout these shows. So if you people of long-time listeners of Letters from KFM may have noticed, it's not run as long. We're looking to do two short-form questions, kind of history segment, and then the long-form question where we may get a little bit deeper. So send your questions in, as I said, to lettersfromcenterstage@gmail.com, or you can hit us up at place2BNation on Twitter. For yourself, JT, and for myself, it's Alan_CheapShot. And you can also find some of my infamous YouTube playlists if you go to tinyurl.com/playlistwrestling. And fingers crossed there'll be a playlist for each and every one of the shows for Letters from Center Stage. Otherwise, we may upset one Cassius Ohno, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah, we need to keep him happy. He's our biggest fan, I hope.
Oh, a big shot now is Cassius, isn't he? Yeah, we want to keep that guy happy. So yeah, really pleased for him. He's doing great there in NXT. So I think we should wrap it up, JT. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show.
Yeah, we had a great time. We'll be back next week, each and every, I guess, Friday morning this will drop. If you're on Alan's side of the pond, it'll be there when you wake up. And for us here, it'll be in the middle of the night on Fridays. But it will be up around that time each and every week. PlaceNation.com. Be sure to check it out each and every day as well. And on Facebook, you can find us at Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation. So for Alan, I'm JT. We'll talk to you next week from the mothership.
Don't mess with Johnny B. Bay.